Hello, I'm Father Ray Petrucci. Welcome to Thoughts for the Week. Before we get into our program and I introduce our guest to you, I am going to ask you, our listeners, to consider contacting us. We'd love to hear your thoughts, your ideas. Perhaps there's a topic you'd like us to pursue for you or some comments that might help us help you. So I'm going to give you two ways to reach us. First, put a stamp on an envelope and write us a letter. You would send it to Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466. That's Post Office Box 7466, Greenwich, Connecticut. The zip code in Greenwich is 06836. Again, that is 06836. If you're on the computer and would prefer to email us, easily done, let me give you our address. It is clemens10@aol.com. Let me make sure you have Clemens correctly. That's CLEMONS, the number 10, at AOL.com. And while you're on the computer, I'd like to encourage you to go to our internet magazine, Spirituality for Today. And you can find that at spirituality.org. That's spirituality.org. That's important. And while you're on there, I hope you enjoy the features and articles. But also, you will find Thoughts for the Week, our radio program, and archived a number of programs. And it's kind of nice because you can listen to it at your leisure. Well, now it's time to get to business. And I'd first like to welcome my co-host, Dorothy Riera.
Thank you, Father. Always wonderful to be with you.
A delight to have you with us. And we're really delighted to have a guest who has not been with us for a long time, but we're happy to have him return to us. And it is Father Anthony Ciora, and he is a professor of theology at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. He's, I believe, the vice president for Mission and Catholic Identity. And welcome to Thoughts for the Week again.
Great, Ray. Father Ray, thanks so much. And Dorothy, it's great to see you again. And I am delighted to have received this invitation. I look forward to our time together today.
Well, we're certainly grateful. And what we'd like to do, of course, I realize you're involved with a wide range of concerns and efforts in your work. But one of them has to do with relationships between Jewish and Christian, and I know you've done and have had a lot of various programs here at Sacred Heart, but I'd like to introduce the topic to our listeners. And so, well, maybe we could just begin the discussion by just asking, what do you find to be the important elements in Jewish-Christian relationships?
Well, the relationships between Christians and Jews is critically important for a number of reasons. One, and we can talk about this a bit later, there's a long history of hostilities and animosities between Jews and Christians that went on for centuries. Mm. And not to live in the past, but it's a rather sad history. So the reason why I think, from a Catholic perspective, why this topic is so important is because we've moved to a new place. Mm. Now, when I say we moved to a new place on this question, it's really since the Second Vatican Council, which, as you know, took place from 1962 through 1965. Now, in church time, that's like yesterday. Mm-hmm. That's only 50-some years. 50 years is nothing, right? In church time. Mm-hmm. The church thinks in centuries, right? And so even though in our documents and in our theology, we've shifted. What my concern is this: how does this now filter down to the people, to the person in the pew, who may never pick up one of these documents, all right, or never pick up the literature per se, but still might be carrying some of these prejudices? And I would mention, I've seen the prejudices and hostilities on both sides, right? Now, I'm going to be talking from a Catholic perspective, but on both sides. And something that's dear to my heart is that when we talk about Jews, Christians, and Muslims, we're worshiping the same God, right? We're worshiping the one God. And I have found within all three traditions that we silo God in the three traditions. And I do believe that at the end of the day, for God is about unity, see? And Jesus had a passion for unity. Before he died, those were his words, that they might be one, right? So it's that passion for unity that energizes me or motivates me on this topic. How do we bring all this together? I would mention, secondly, here at Sacred Heart University, on two points. First, students. Students, in some instances, for example, the fact that Jesus was a Jew, some are surprised. He was a Jew. Really? Yeah, he was a Jew. Mary was a Jew. Really? Right? So you have this issue with students. And you know this, Father Ray. What's happening also, there are now more and more interreligious weddings. All right?
Yes.
And so this is where the rubber meets the road, mm-hmm. and you run into some of this there. I just ran into this yesterday, which I'll talk about a bit later, because now you're talking about, say, a rabbi or even a priest who's not well-versed in this, who might be carrying baggage, right? Mm-hmm. And you also have couples getting married who have no idea. How do you blend the two, and how do you remain faithful to both traditions?
And it reflects on the families, too.
And not only that, when they see that there's conflict between the two religions, they just go outside the religion and marry by a judge.
Yeah.
So this does not interfere with their life. Yeah. And they abandon their beliefs.
Oh, yeah. Well, and what happens, as you know, Dorothy, we live in a culture that's a secular culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of us are being pulled into this secular culture. And see, something like this where they could feel that religion is not meaningful or religion is in conflict, well, especially with younger generations, they walk away. There's a recent work that's called Go, Going, Gone,
yes,
sociological studies that talks about it, especially young people walk away. And it's stuff like this that could get them to walk away. So, for example, you start arguing about you call God this or you call God that. Or the other side of it is you get into a relativism. You say, well, no religion matters, right? So Christianity is just another raisin in the cosmic muffin in the sky. Right, so you want to look at the beauty in both religions, and how do you, in some way, honor both, and live together in peace? And there's a richness if, in fact, you can bring both traditions into your family life.
Now, in talking about that, when I did a little research, we go back in time to, as you mentioned, and it's not a long period of time as the church considers things, but to some of the work of Pope John the 23rd. Mm-hmm. Now, this is some of the early times of the role that he had played in these relations between Jew and Christian. And this, I assume, even drifts into the World War II experience, too. Mm-hmm. Could you share some of the ideas there from in regard to Pope John the 23rd?
Yeah, Pope John the 23rd, for many reasons, Father Ray, is a pivotal figure in history of Catholicism. And I feel, just my own opinion, he, more than any other, has really moved the church into a new place with the Second Vatican Council. See, John the 23rd was elected pope in 1959, right? And when he was elected pope, I think he was 78 years old or 79, which, by the way, that's looking younger and younger to me.
Every year,
he was a young guy when he was elected pope. And so when he was elected, they expected that, they were looking for an interim after the long reign of Pius XII. Well, this guy will be in a couple of years, then he'll die and he'll be out. They never expected that he was going to bring monumental change, right? And so shortly after he was elected, it was he was elected in October, if I remember correctly. On January 25th of 1960, he goes to St. Paul outside the wall, which is, for those of you not familiar, that's the one basilica that's outside the walls of the Vatican. So beautiful. It's my favorite, by the way. And there were about 13 or 14 cardinals there. And if you can see the pictures of this, they were all dressed in their regalia, and they didn't look too happy. They were the old guard.
Mm-hmm.
So John the 23rd says, well, I have three announcements to make. He says, the first is there'll be a synod in the Diocese of Rome. Like, who really cares, right? Mm-hmm. And he's stuck in the middle. I'm going to call a Council Universal Church. And then he says, we're going to do a revision of the code of canon law. So he slipped it in there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if you recall this, and they're looking, what did he just say?
Right?
What did he do? Right? And they were flabbergasted by this. Right? Now, the question of the council, this is not your primary question here, but it was really the history of John the 23rd's life, plus the council, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, the document of the council, Nostra Aetate, that makes this shift happen. But the person of John the 23rd is key, and I'll tell you why. John the 23rd, who was the papal nuncio in a couple of different places, he was in Bulgaria. He was from Bulgaria. He went to Greece and Turkey. And then from Greece and Turkey, he went to France. And it was during this, you mentioned the Second World War, he was in Turkey. See, oftentimes they refer to John the 23rd as the good pope, right? The good John the 23rd, right? And even as he, when he was papal nuncio, they called him the good nuncio. He had a very, for those not familiar with John the 23rd, he had a very down-to-earth way of being with people. So, to fast forward, throughout his life, he had an understanding of the Jews and the importance of, even as Christianity, being rooted within Judaism. But beyond that, he also had an affection for the Jews. So even in Bulgaria, he was seeking ways, how do we help the Jewish people who were being marginalized, right? And by the way, even when he became pope, the Jews even in Rome were still marginalized. They were living in the ghetto, or the ghetto, we say, right, on the outskirts of Rome. So this is recent where this is going on, right? But when he, this is the important point. When he was the nuncio in Turkey, this is during the war, right, and this was during Nazi Germany, right? What he was doing, because of the Jews, he was writing false baptismal certificates. I don't know if you remember this.
He actually wrote that's the way a lot of the Jewish people were able to escape Nazism.
Well, yeah, because he actually wrote these certificates, right, pretending that they were Christian in order to save their lives. So this, when you talk to Jewish people, they're very moved by this, right? Because he was someone who, as the kids would say today, walked the walk. He laid his life down in order to save Jews. So I say all of this as in the conversation we have this afternoon. This is his mentality. He's very much in terms of how do we embrace the other.
Now, when we think of his successor, we move on to Paul the VI. And he establishes a commission now for relations between Jews and Christians. Now, is that commission an immediate result from Vatican II? Of course, he had to take over in regard to the Second Vatican Council after the death of John the 23rd. Is his relationship the same or similar to John's, or was he coming from a different perspective when he thought of the need for this commission?
Well, see, Paul the VI, Cardinal Martini, right? He was, John the 23rd was only pope for 3 years, right? And he began the council, but it was Paul the VI who really carried it through and had to live with the aftermath of the council. Paul the VI was a very different personality. Earlier when I spoke of John the 23rd, there was something about his person. He was like a religious Santa Claus. You saw him, you would want to hug him and give him your
list. It looked like it, too.
Give him your list, what do I want for Christmas? And this guy, he was this type. With John the 23rd, you could not be afraid. He was so close, right? I think, by the way, this is anecdotal, the day after he was elected, he was walking in St. Peter's Square, and a group of women says, "Oh, my God, he is ugly." He looks at them and says, "It wasn't a beauty contest, you know."
Yeah,
he had that kind of humor.
Yeah.
Paul the VI was a much more serious personality. It was a personality trait of his. Having said that, he was just as committed. And see, some of the structural changes, which we'll, I'm sure we'll get into as part of this conversation, really came under his pontificate. He continued the energy that John the 23rd began, and he was as equally as committed. And it was Paul the VI who created, who began to create structures to institutionalize, if you will, our relationship with the Jews. He was more the thinker, more the theologian. John the 23rd was very spontaneous. Mm-hmm. Paul the VI thought everything through. John the 23rd used to call him my Hamlet because he would agonize over things. But as he would agonize, he would then come to his decision. In the case of the Jews, he made some very good choices.
Well, isn't there in the documents of Vatican II a specific document concerning Jewish relationships with the Christians?
Yeah, that's a great point, Dorothy. And this is important because it's really that document that got the ball rolling, mm-hmm. right? The document is called Nostra Aetate, right? Which means in the season. With these documents, they take the first two Latin words, and that's what it means. But very briefly, it was a watershed document, right? There were two documents at the council that had to do with our relationship with other religions. One was our relationship with other Christian religions, which is not our purpose here today, and the other was our relationship to non-Christian religions, which Nostra Aetate is. Which, by the way, you could read Nostra Aetate in a half hour. I mean, it's like five pages.
Mm-hmm.
But the five pages are packed with a vision that is to set the church on a new path, for this sense. In Nostra Aetate, what the document says is this, that anything that is helping other people, anything that's about the good, anything that's about beauty, we're on your side, right? And so it's saying the church rejects no one who is seeking the good, rejects no one who wants to be involved with others. We accept, we don't reject. Now, this is new. Now, it sounds kind of very simple, but it's new.
Mm-hmm.
We're opening doors, right? Before, the doors and the windows were pretty shut. I'm not criticizing. I'm just naming it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's opening. The door is wide open, right, to other religious traditions. Now, specifically, talks about the heart of the matter. It talks about all religious traditions, and even atheists, by the way. However, in light of our conversation here, the heart of the matter in that document is our relationship with Jews and Muslims. Mm-hmm. That's the heart of the text. Specifically in terms of the Jews, it opens up a whole new chapter. Not even chapter. It's a new book that's opened in the document.
Now, you brought up that important issue between relationships between other religions other than Judaism, but especially in Muslims, because we're right smack in the Middle East now, and our diplomatic relations. Now, I guess we're developing theological and political with the state of Israel. I believe that was set in 1993. Mm-hmm. I guess a two-pronged question. How did that, or what impact did that have in regard to our theological and political understanding of being united or relating to growing a sense of unity, and what aspects that was? Maybe we could talk about that. But also, what also did that mean to our relationship with the other Arab states?
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps maybe beginning with Israel itself, that idea of establishing diplomatic relations, what impact did that have in regard to
wider sense? Now we're going into the politics, you know. My mother used to say, we don't argue religion or politics or anything that goes into the frying pan. No, we're in the frying pan. We have both in here.
Yeah, we're talking about both.
So this is now moving into the political dimension, and of course, in a positive sense, the church has a political agenda because the Vatican is a country, if you will, it's a state.
It's a country,
right?
Yeah.
And so the fact that we would open up relationships, a structural political relationship with Israel, at the state of Israel. Now, this is a side point which maybe we come back to, which is supposed to include the Palestinian territories.
Yes.
But see, now that's very complicated, and
that
we can
is.
Come back to that if you're interested in this. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of work in that area, but to stay on message here, that the opening up of the diplomatic relations in 1993, right, that now the church has a formal relationship with the government of the state of Israel. And so in 1993, we opened up an embassy there, like any other country would have an embassy. We now have an embassy. Now, it was also significant that in 1994, that Israel went to the Vatican, and they have an embassy there as well. Mm-hmm. So we have a diplomatic relationship with the state of Israel. So, Father Ray and Dorothy, these diplomatic relations was important for many reasons. Prior to 1993, the apostolic delegate to Jerusalem and Palestine, see, the Pope's representative to that part of the world was both to Jerusalem and Palestine. It was including both, right? So also there is the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem,
yes.
Right? And so the Patriarch also is representing the Pope. And there was also the custodian of the Holy Land, the Franciscan friars. So you had those three structures, if you will, that represented the Holy See, right? So now, in fact, those three structures are still there. But now, with diplomatic relations being opened, we have now, it's a unified effort, and that, in fact, we have an actual diplomat appointed by the Holy See, that what you have there, the Pope's representative isn't just the apostolic, he's the nuncio, all right? So he's the official delegate of the Holy See. To Israel. So what it does is that it gets into theological and political modes of action, all right? Mm-hmm. So there's a theological issue that comes into play about our acceptance of the Jews and the Jews accepting us, but it also gets into the politics of Israel, all right, in terms of its relationship to the United States, but more importantly, in relationship to Palestine, all right, and especially to fast forward, that's become more complex. And so the Holy See, Rome, our Holy Father, has to juggle both, right? And we also now, it's separated, we also have Palestine has a representative to the Holy See, and the Holy See now is a representative of Palestine as separate from Israel, because they're two separate entities side by side. So there's a deep complexity of all of this that I think is important to name, because this has implications for world politics and much of our life today, especially in the post 9/11 world.
But it's amazing that these three religions live side by side, because when you have the Wailing Wall, you have the Holy Sepulchre Church, and then you have
Dome of the
Rock. Dome of the Rock from the Muslims. And they're all 25 steps from each other.
Well, you know, to put it negatively, Dorothy, somebody's always mad about something.
Yeah.
that's the other side of it. I have been there 18 times.
Wow.
And it's an interesting phenomenon. There's a saying, I think exactly how it goes. The first time I went to the Holy Land, right, I knew the answer to everything. Second time, I even had more answers. The third and fourth time, I had fewer answers. Now I go there, I have no answers. it's different cultures, and there's layers and layers and layers of complexity here that's hard for us in the Western world to understand.
Yes.
The Middle East is filled with nuance.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you go, quite frankly, the less you understand. There's many questions. Many.
Well, you just think of the centuries and almost millennia of history of conflict and, back to Islam, to the Crusades, back and forth, and how often these churches became mosques and they became churches back and forth.
But you know what I'm interested in the present day, because we only have a couple of minutes left. How would you see the relationship? Because I've talked to some individuals along the way of saying, you know, Christians have a hard time still in Israel, especially if they're hoping to establish businesses or whatever. And I'm just wondering, how are things, the relationship there between these religions and functioning?
Well, there's a tension, all right? And even, by the way, one of the things that's being talked about now is taxing some of our, even like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, for example. And there's been some protest on the Christian side. So when you get into the politics of it all, Christianity, in 1980, the population was 20% Christian. About 10 years ago, it was 2%. Now it's less than 2%. So the problem is the lack of a Christian voice in the context of Israel. And there's a marginalization of Christianity along with Islam. Not that it's necessarily intentional, it might or might not be, but Christians are finding it more and more difficult to live there. And the problem is when you go to the churches, for example, the churches are becoming museums.
Mm-hmm.
Because community is drifting. They're leaving because it's hard for them to live there.
You have time. Well, that. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine, Father. Thanks.
Fortunately, we are running out of time, unfortunately, for this program. But when we look at the situation, and we'd love to expand on this, generally, do you have a positive note toward, or feelings, with all the complexities, a sense of hope toward that?
There is. And the hope is this, that since John the 23rd, Paul the 6th, and John Paul the 2nd, and now with Pope Francis, we have not lost our resolve to remain close to the Jews.
Okay.
And also the other hope is this. The future of world peace, in my opinion, world peace, depends upon the dialogue among religions.
Okay.
So I have great hope because we're committed to that dialogue.
Well, I have to draw everything to a close on a hopeful note, thank goodness. And thank you for listening. And Father Sciorra, thank you for being with us. We'll be together again next week.